Welcome. This is Deanna Spingola, and this is Spingola and Friends. It is Monday, August 25th, 2014, and we have no corporate sponsors for this weekly radio program. Therefore, it is for people who can really handle the truth. My website is spingola.com. There you will find information about my books, The Ruling Elite series. I also invite you to look at the timeline of book 2 and 3, which is a work in progress. I would love to have you visit the website of a friend and listener who has created and maintains the website, spingolaspeaks.wordpress.com. And on that website, you will find the more recent audio files of all of my programs, including RBN and from American Free Press, the program that the sponsor of the previous program that I was on Blog Talk, and then, of course, these programs. If you have questions during the program, feel free to call 646-787-1915. We will also be taking questions and comments from the listeners via my email, comment@spingola.com, or from the chat room, which is spingola.chatango.com. Our guests today are 30-06 and Magyar Saxon. 30's website is notimeforsilence.wordpress.com. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Deanna.
Hello.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Well, thank you so much. And we're going to talk about, as we were mentioning just before we went on the air, about something that's, rather controversial. And of course, I never talk about anything controversial. So this will be a first for me, right? I guess that's why I'm doing Blog Talk and why I'm no longer doing some of the other corporate-sponsored radio programs.
Well, Deanna, I would like to start. I hear our music.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. Makes a nice background.
Hang on. Let me just click
that. We can leave it on there. That's fine.
Off there. Okay.
I would like to open today's event in solemn commemoration of a fallen soldier. A soldier who fought with absolute loyalty and devotion for his people throughout his lifetime. On 30th of July of this year, our comrade Manfred Roeder passed into eternity. Manfred Roeder was a young soldier in the Wehrmacht. He fought in the Battle of Berlin. He continued to fight throughout the rest of his life for the honor in the future of his German people. He was, in fact, a hero of the white race. He inspired thousands upon thousands of white men and women around the world to stand up with loyalty and devotion and to serve their people and to fight for their people's future. Due to his activities, he was labeled in the German press as a neo-Nazi terrorist leader, and he was vilified at every turn. On one occasion, there was this Jewish head of some Jewish blah, 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 poor us organization over there who spent his time always defaming the German people. At one occasion, Manfred Roeder referred to him as a loudmouth. For this speech from Manfred Roeder, the reference to this Jew as a loudmouth, Manfred Roeder spent 21 months in prison. Because in Jewish Zionist-occupied Germany, Germans have no ability to speak in defense of Germans. Because as the Jewish occupation authorities insist, Germany has no heroes. Germans are villains. Only the Jews have heroes. And this is what we are going to talk about today, is the great vilification of our heroes. And the great...
Yeah, I had not heard of this gentleman before.
Yes, he was a very loyal German. And he was an inspiration to all who knew him. He was considered a radical.
Now, was he a neo-Nazi? Did he endorse the program and policies?
Yes, that's why he was considered a radical. Even many of the activists in many of the nationalist organizations in Germany were afraid to be connected with him because he was outspoken, and he said that the National Socialist regime was the best thing for Germany, and you're not allowed to say that in Germany today.
Right.
But today we're going to talk about an American.
Okay. Magyar, did you have something to?
Yeah, I would just like to say that, about the term hero. It's tossed about a lot today, and they even call sports guys heroes. But there's a traditional kind of hero is somebody who, maybe in a battle, like in a popular war, in a battle, they give their life to save their comrades or something like that. But when you talk about somebody like Rockwell or Manfred Ritter, these guys are really unqualified heroes in my mind because they stood up, against all opposition. It was not a popular cause at the time, but they stood up for the truth. And Rockwell was cut down because I gave his life to it. And he was an extremely bright man. He could have gone far in the business world, but he was a guy who just he had to speak the truth as he saw it, and it brought nothing but trouble to him personally, and that to me is a real hero. And then he ultimately gave up his life for it. So Rockwell was a great inspiration to me as a young man and how I got into the movement, and he's an unqualified hero in my mind.
All right. Yeah, it is amazing how that word hero is tossed around just kind of indiscriminately. And of course, when you look at young adults in today's society, their heroes seem to be the people that people a few generations ago would consider some of the kind of really not very heroic at all. I mean, they're just rock stars and that kind of person. Ah, gosh. I mean, haven't things changed? Used to be young people would read books, children would read books, and they could pick out heroes, whether they were, the frontiersmen or some people like that. I hate to even use the word politician and hero in the same sentence, but there were some that people thought of as heroic. Now it's just so, that word is so adulterated.
Well, when I was a kid, I remember in grade school, and I mean, every classroom, there was a picture of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln up in the room. And as far as I know, they've pretty much been taken down because they're controversial figures now. I mean, that would have been unthinkable to my parents and grandparents. I think it's difficult for young people today to picture Rockwell's time even. I mean, he died today on this day in 1967. But it's hard for me even sometimes to remember life before the Internet, before cell phones, when there was only three TV networks. I was raised 40 miles outside of Philadelphia, and we had three TV channels, and they were all run by by Jews, and they pretty much decided what was news and what wasn't. And you had people like Walter Cronkite, at the end of the newscast, he'd say, "That's the way it is today. That's it," is what he was saying. Mm-hmm. "That's all the news as decided by my boss," you know. And
sure.
Your own president could say something, and if they decided it wasn't newsworthy, you didn't hear about it. So Rockwell had came up with some brilliant ideas on how to break through what he called the paper curtain, you know, because you couldn't just Google something and find like-minded people around the country and the world. I mean, you had to somehow get mentioned on one of these three networks, and it was very difficult to do.
Indeed.
This was the thing that motivated, that got Rockwell started. He tried to work with the many different groups throughout in the middle 1950s, and he could see that they were never getting anywhere. It was always the crowd talking to the crowd, and they were never reaching the public. They were never reaching out there and getting the ordinary guy and bring the facts of this fight that we are engaged in today, bringing the awareness of this ongoing war that was being waged against the white race by this gang of international Jewish communists and international Jewish Zionists.
And
he had just discovered this in the early 1950s during the Korean War. He had come to realize facts which were surprising and shocking to him. He was not aware of them before. He was a Navy pilot in the United States Navy in World War II. He left Brown University in March of 1941 and enlisted in the United States Navy to become a pilot. He wanted to be a fighter pilot. He wanted to meet the enemy head on in combat. That's the type of man he was. He was a man of action. And when he discovered the treachery and the subversion that was being conducted against us, he knew he had to act, and he had to find a way, as Magyar has stated, to break through the curtain of silence that the Jews and their control of the media had brought down over America.
Now, I listened to one of the audios that you had on your website. And again, that website is notimeforsilence.wordpress.com. And if you visit the site, look for Rockwell's name under Commander Rockwell, and so it's up at the top in the list near the top. And he was, as you said, he fought in World War II, and he was, I think, probably your typical American who bought the lies, according to what he said, who bought the lies that the Germans were just terrible, that we needed to, that the Americans needed to hate them, needed to go over there and just slaughter them and get rid of them. And what changed his views? What did he see? You said that he began to change in the early 1950s, right around the Korean War.
This was during the Korean conflict. He
mm-hmm.
he was one of the many Americans who were outraged when MacArthur was pulled back from fighting aggressively against the Chinese in the North Korean in the Korean conflict. Truman and his Jewish advisors fired General MacArthur because he wanted to win that war. And MacArthur was outraged over this, and he was in San Diego at the time. He was training Marine and Naval jet fighter pilots for the war. And he saw an ad in a newspaper. This woman, not an ad, but a little editorial article, this woman was declaring that she wanted to get a rally for General MacArthur going, but she was unable to rent a hall. And Commander Rockwell contacted her, and he said, "Well, I can help you get a hall." And she invited him to come up and visit. And he drove up, visited her and her husband in the cottage they were in. And he started talking to her about renting a halls. And she just said, "Well, they won't let you do that." And he was, Commander Rockwell was surprised. He said, what do you mean they won't let you, who won't let you do that? And she looked at her husband, and she looked at Commander Rockwell, and she said, the Jews. And Rockwell said, the Jews? What have the Jews got to do with it? And she proceeded to explain the stranglehold that the Jews have over political speaking in the United States, and Rockwell was really set back by this. He thought this sounded really strange. But she provided him then with some, she started showing him some stuff out of some books and some literature that she had and some tracts from Gerald L. K. Smith and his publication, The Cross and the Flag, and newspapers, the Common Sense newspapers published by Condé McGinley. And she gave Rockwell a lot of this material, and he went back to his to Coronado base, and he wasn't, on one hand, he almost didn't even want to look at this literature because he thought it all sounded nutty. But he got to reading it after a few days, and he started seeing all these facts presented. So he thought, well, he's going to check this out. So he goes down to the San Diego Public Library when he had a chance, and he started checking, and every fact he checked, it checked out. And he thought to himself, well, if this story is true, this is simply an absolute outrage, and you have to stand up and fight it. But he just couldn't believe it was true. So he just kept digging in and researching more and more, and the more he researched, the more he found out it was all true. The Jews have this conspiracy against America, against white America, and he thought, this is incredible. How could this be? But then he thought, wait a minute. This is talking about the Bolsheviks, the Jews, and communism. Now, Adolf Hitler just waged a war against the communists. So he goes down to a bookshop in San Diego, and he finds a copy of Mein Kampf. And he started reading Mein Kampf. And that's when, as he said, the awakening began. And it was the end of one George Lincoln Rockwell, the ordinary American, and the birth of George Lincoln Rockwell, the revolutionary.
I think that's a that's another thing that's hard for young people today to picture was during that time. I mean, the threat of communism, it wasn't an academic matter. I remember as a kid, you know, in school we used to do the drills where we'd go into the basement and sit on the floor with your knees up, put your head down between your legs and cover your neck. And it was supposed to, you know, protect you somewhat from a nuclear blast. This is like during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And there was a steel mill fairly close to where I lived. And we had heard that that was one of the targets that the Soviets had missiles pointed at. So there was a fear as a kid growing up then. I mean, there was a real fear of communism. And like 30-06 says, you know, the Korean vets had come back. And previous to that, there were, especially in the East European communities in America, there were many stories and Russians and all of what the Bolsheviks had done in those countries. Horrible, you know, burning churches and raping nuns and real horror stories. So there was a real fear of communism. And, you know, that's much of what drove Rockwell. But there was two big issues in Rockwell's times. And one was the breaking down of white supremacy in the United States, and the other was the issue of communism, and that, and he pretty much focused on those issues because that's what was on people's mind. And I mean, it's a time when college students used to protest and, you know, against racial integration. So, as you said earlier, you know how much things have changed. I mean, it's just very difficult to imagine. And you know, I remember those days as a child, and. And then as a young teen, it was coming to an end, and Rockwell was trying to, you know, there were a lot of people that were against integration, and even some of the more ignorant-sounding people that they love to show on these documentaries today, some ignorant-sounding guy in the South talking about, you know, Negroes or something to try to make him look bad. But if you listen to what he's saying, very often what they their fears came true. I mean, the schools are not better places now that they've been integrated all these years, especially for little white children. I mean, I believe, you know, slavery was wrong and all that, but especially the working class white people of this country, many of them who came from East European, South European countries long after slavery was over, had nothing to do with it. And Rockwell addressed all those things, but he was pretty much focused on those two issues, you know, anti-communism and anti-integration.
Interesting. Yes, those were interesting times. And there's so many factors that played into what made them very interesting times. That was a lot of cultural things. You had rock music became very popular, and the anti-war protests, and during the 60s, it was just very, very interesting times.
Well, you know, the anti-communist movement was huge. The conservatives back then, and you had groups like the John Birch Society and all. And I think Rockwell, in his Brown University speech, he said that he became a conservative at first.
Right.
And he just saw how ineffective it was, and especially after he realized the Jewish role in communism, and he had made the statement that he felt that that's why the John Birch Society never got anywhere, because they always claimed that they loved Jews but they hated communists. And he said that was like saying you love to go swimming but you hate to get wet. You just can't do it, you know.
Right.
And, yeah, so.
In fact, I'm sorry. I was a member at one point of the John Birch Society, and gosh, you're right. They just never mentioned the Jewish influence in communism. And there was just something that, you know, just a gut feeling that we're doing all of these things, and yet we're going nowhere. We're just running in place here and
yep,
not
yep.
really accomplishing anything at all.
And that's exactly what Commander Rockwell come to that conclusion in the late 1950s. Rockwell was the when he started looking in and researching communism, he got right down to the core of the matter. He traced it back by studying the Jews and looking into them more closely, and he found a 4,000-year pattern of parasitism upon the world by the Jews. And he spoke about this, and he narrowed it down. He said essentially that he described communism more direct, get to the core of the problem nature than anyone else. He said that communism is the mutiny of the inferior masses of the world, the lower elements of humanity, led by the Jew and thrust into a campaign of destruction of the natural superior elements of humanity, the best of humanity. The white race, for example, and especially the better elements of the white race, the naturally superior leadership of the world. This was under attack by this Jewish Bolshevik conspiracy. And no one else would dare address that. Rockwell laid it out that communism was essentially nothing but a Jewish-led race war against white people. And in 1962, I believe it was, at a speech at a college in Northfield, Minnesota, he addressed the audience there, and he said to them, he said, if you are a fanatic, you can accomplish great things. We are fanatics. The Jews and the communists are fanatics. The rest of the people are in between. They are the ones who read newspapers, who watch TV, who read comic books and cheap magazines, and they are the spectators at ball games. And what he was saying essentially was that this struggle that we are engaged in is a struggle of two camps, two opposing camps of fanatics who will decide the fate, the death direction of the world. And
wow.
The people in between would only come in eventually and support whoever they thought was the strongest and in charge. And this is proven. If you look and examine society, this is precisely what you see happening in every turn. The masses essentially worship power, and they submit to power. They don't care who it is or what it does. And the only way you're going to overthrow an evil power, which is what Commander Rockwell said we were doing, was to become, in the minds of the public, in the image of the public, the stronger power. You had to have the show of force. You had to exude power and force. And he stated, he equated our position today as National Socialists and as white revolutionaries as being akin to the Christians in the Roman Empire. The Christians in the Roman Empire were essentially revolutionaries against the corrupt, dying, decadent empire. They were persecuted and hated by the empire and by the good, respectable citizens, the average man on the street. They were despised. They were persecuted. They were murdered. They were butchered. They were thrown to the lions. Exactly the same thing that happens to National Socialists. When Adolf Hitler freed the German people from Jewish parasites, the world of this modern-day Roman Empire, led by Britain, America, and the Soviet Union in partnership, launched an all-out war to destroy Germany and then to persecute all who sought freedom from Jewish rule.
Wow, that is really quite a comparison that I had not ever thought about before.
Well, that's that was a rare thing about Rockwell, that he realized that you had to inspire people with deeds and action. Especially today with the Internet, there are so many blogs, there's so much information out there, but the vast majority of people, they don't really react to information. I mean, just two examples. Liberals are, I mean, the scientific facts of race are out there. They're pretty obvious and undeniable, in my opinion. And but liberals will not acknowledge that. They keep, looking for excuses. On the other hand, conservatives, they will not acknowledge the facts of something like global warming, the environmental problems we have, because both groups, they cling to their to the culture around their idea, and they're not budged by the facts. And it's only deeds that inspire people to action. And Rockwell realized that, and that's one of the things. As a young man, I was 13 years old, I guess, when Rockwell was killed. And in fact, that's how I first heard about him. I was watching the late news, 11 o'clock at night, and I heard about this leader of the American Nazi Party who was assassinated in Virginia that day. And I was in shock because my family, I mean, my mother would tell us, believed all the stuff that was perpetrated, all the lies back then. Heard about, Jews being made into lampshades and soap and all that stuff. And then Eichmann trial had just taken place or right before that, and so I had all this stuff in my head, and I was shocked to hear there was such a thing as an American Nazi Party. And then it was a few years, shortly thereafter, there was a kid in school who had one of those old boat tickets back to Africa. It was a comical thing that Rockwell's the American Nazi Party had put out, and on the back of it there was a little coupon where you could cut out and send it in for information for a more serious look. I think it said something like that, for a more serious look at the race problems in America. So I sent my dollar in, and the information arrived, and I guess it came when I was still in school. My mother had gotten the mail, and she was horrified, tore it up, threw it in the trash, and somehow I saw it. It was a big family fight, and I took the trash, I dumped it out in my room, locked the door, spent hours taping it all together so I could read this stuff. And then I started getting the information to my friend's house, who had given me the showed me the boat ticket. So I got that for a while, and then gradually my mother came to respect my ideas, and I started explaining the truth to her. But I was very much inspired by as the more I read and I understood the kind of man Rockwell was, I was very much motivated by the fact that you cannot just let a good man that stands up for truth that's cut down like that. You have to pick up the flag, and you cannot let him die in vain. And then, you know, you come to realize that he was like the latest one to die for that cause, and that millions had died of good men and women had died for that cause during the Second World War. You know, so it's actions. Rockwell realized so well that it was actions that inspired deeds, bold deeds that inspired people, and not just academic arguments. You know, I think that's one of the mistakes that libertarians make so often. Most libertarians I know are intelligent people, and they sort of assume that everybody else is intelligent, and if they just read the facts, they'll be swayed. But people are more swayed by emotions and the peer group they belong to. You know, if you're a liberal and you suddenly start talking about Jews, or, you know, maybe there's an inherited problem with blacks' intelligence or something like that, well, you won't get invited to wine and cheese parties anymore. And, you know, if you're conservative, you start talking about some of these other things, you won't get invited to their party. So, and most people, being accepted in their group and by their neighbors is the most important thing. So Rockwell understood all that.
Interesting. And there were so many interesting, as you were talking, I was thinking about all the things that happened right around that time. Of course, you have the JFK assassination, you have the immigration changes in 1965, you had the introduction of Medicare in 65. And so much civil unrest, and of course civil unrest is where the elite make the greatest changes. That is when people are kind of traumatized, and it's so easy to sway the public to bring them to the point where you want them. And so when you look at the 60s, and gosh, assassinations. And, of course, I always think that the JFK assassination, of course, was a coup. And I think that you could probably say that the assassination of Rockwell was also a coup, wouldn't you say?
They were definitely revolutionary times. I mean, the riots in the streets and assassinations of political figures It was a definite change. It was, you know, in the 1950s. I mean, I remember when Kennedy was assassinated. I was in fifth grade, and I mean, the whole country, everybody was in shock and in mourning. You know, and it was back then. It was sort of, especially with the Cold War going on. He was our president, and you know, if after the elections, people kind of came together a little more, and so he was our president, and it's different now. I mean, the last couple presidents, if they had been cut down an assassination, half the nation would be cheering, whether it was a Republican or a Democrat. You know, we're really divided now, and of course the immigration is so increased. When I was a kid there, just like I said, 40 miles outside of Philadelphia, another thing I remember, one time there was a black guy came into a thrift drugstore. They used to have like a counter, or a Woolworths, I think it was, a Woolworths lunch counter, and a black guy came in there, and I remember my mother telling me, it's a colored man, it's not nice to stare, you know, because I just never saw any 40 miles outside of Philadelphia. It really was like the Andy Griffith show in Mayberry in much of the country. And that was the beginning of that change, the Immigration Acts, and it's just very, very different times. It was a revolution, a watershed time.
Indeed. And I really hadn't, of course, I was brainwashed too. And I really totally believe the Holocaust had occurred, and I was into reading all about the Holocaust, about the In fact, I think one of the first books that I read, maybe one of the second books that I read, was The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Scherer. And it didn't occur to me that that wasn't true, that all of that was simply propaganda. Just never, because we're all raised to believe that what we read in a book is pretty much true. I mean, that's how we're taught in school. We go to school and we read these books and we learn truth. And so you just kind of assume that whatever you read in a book is going to be educational, when in fact it's, well, I think probably school is the last place that we get educated.
Yeah. It's true. You know, my son and I were talking about the Holocaust because we, you know, questions here about Babi Yar and all these different places, massacres and so forth, and you wonder because, you know, no normal person wants to be a part of anything that's, you know, a murderous group that kills innocent people. I mean, it's just not normal to want to be a part of that. So I think, you know, all of us who end up calling ourselves National Socialists at some point struggle with that or question some of these things. But like what Rockwell used to say in checking with it, it just does not add up. It's not to say that there weren't atrocities. It's not to say that there weren't innocent people killed. That happens in every war on all sides. I mean, that's the nature of war. That's why we should try to avoid it as much as we can. But it's not really any different than what happened to anybody else. I mean, there were tens of thousands of innocent, you know, Germans and millions of Germans and Hungarians and Czechs and all, you know, on and on and on. But we just hear about the Holocaust like it's something so special. And I think Le Pen once said in France, he got in trouble for it, he said that the Holocaust was a footnote, a mere footnote to World War II. When you consider all of the suffering, all of the atrocities, all of the terrible things that happened, you know. So,
sure.
But, yeah, those stories, it's, I read Shire's book too, and, you know, it's just a bombardment of movies and it really goes back to what Hitler said, you know, the big lie theory, that the average person can't imagine a lie on that much of that big of a scale, you know, so
sure.
They sort of just figure, well, there has to be something to it, you know.
Sure. And that's actually been taken out of context. Because when he was talking about propaganda and the big lie, he was referring to the people who use the big lie. He was referring to the Jewish population and their efficiency and their effectiveness in using repetitive lying. And and of course, when you take it out of context, as so many people have, they attribute it to Hitler and saying that, oh, he was brainwashing the Germans. And they believed everything, and that he was using the big lie method, which he wasn't. In fact, the German people learned propaganda really from the English and from the Americans.
Yes,
I will add that
true.
They did not follow suit. Germans. If you look at the films of the war produced in Germany that were shown in theaters in the Reich, they never talked about the war. If you look at the films produced in America during the war, that's all you got was war hate propaganda.
Right. Absolutely.
And the Germans never resorted to that.
And, Manyar, when you were talking about hiding under the desk and putting your head down, there was a film that Walt Disney produced. It was called Duck and Cover. And when you
said that, I thought about that. Yeah, that's a term that you. I think that's what they used to call. Yeah, that's
sure.
I had forgotten what they called that. You're right. Yeah.
Sure. So
yeah,
they were getting everybody involved with war propaganda, including Walt Disney in Walt Disney Studio.
You know, there's a book. The author passed away recently. It's a fairly recent book from a couple of years ago. Salty, I think, is his name, who wrote it. It's about Hitler. I forget the title offhand. But anyway, in there, I remember he mentions the fact that Hitler and his generation had just, the ones who survived, had just come through 4 years of trench warfare in World War I. Horrible conditions with poison gas attacks, and it was the first war. I mean, they were still using like older tactics of mass charges, like in the Civil War and so forth, but now they had industrial machines for weapons, like machine guns, and so the losses and the mayhem was horrendous. And Hitler, he quotes in there somewhere, sources where Hitler had once said that we killed perfectly honorable Frenchmen and Englishmen for 4 years in the trenches. So, you know, we had to do that for the fatherland. He said, you know, if we have to get rough with, like, I'm just paraphrasing, but if we have to get rough with communists and despicable enemies of Germany, I mean, you know, it's not going to be that hard for us to do what we have to do, and not implying gas them or any of the lies, but, you know, some tactics. It's easy for people nowadays, you know, you're sitting at your computer and eating a bag of potato chips in your pajamas and you're reading about stuff and you think, oh, geez, how can people be so cruel? How could these things happen? Well, you have to put yourself in the shoes of millions of World War I veterans who came back to defeat war reparations, starvation, no jobs, and like a communist revolution happening right in their own country with Rosa Luxemburg and all those people, and stories coming back from what was taking place in the Soviet Union and the Ukraine, and you really have to keep these things in context, whether it's, you know, Hitler and the early National Socialists or Rockwell in his time. It's hard to do that sometimes, but I think it's absolutely necessary to understand some of the things that were said and done and so forth.
Yes, how true. We do have to look at the times and the and not take things out of context. And, of course, we all hate war. Every one of us do. And Hitler fought in that war, and he was the only leader in Europe that did not want World War II. He was the one that was saying, no, because he had actually fought in World War I. And in fact, even before World War I, it was the Germans who were saying, we do not want war, we want peace, we are not interested in war. The Germans have always sought peace, and they've always been the ones that have sought peace. However, they're always the ones that are blamed. They were blamed for World War I and World War II, because, of course, the victors write the stories and give their version of everything.
Yes. Well, if you look, you know, if you look at a map of right before the outbreak of the Second World War, and you can Google a map of the British Empire and all their holdings, I mean, all over the world. The British were all over the world. French colonies all over the world. The Americans, even at the time, were a lot of different places, the Philippines, Cuba, South America, you know, Manifest Destiny, our hemisphere and all that stuff. And yet we're told that Hitler wanted to conquer the world. And then if you look at what he actually invaded, the land he invaded, they were all ancient German lands, the Sudetenland, up at Danzig, the Polish corridor and the Rhineland. These were little border areas that had been taken from Germany after the First World War, and the German minorities or majorities there were being persecuted by the country that ended up being in control of those areas. And that's what he stated. It's stated in the 25 points, all the very early, the very first National Socialist pamphlets and writings. I mean, that's what they talk about. That's what they want back, is to unite all the Germans in one Reich, like they should be. And yet he's accused of wanting to conquer the world, and it's just an infinitesimal amount of territory that is populated by Germans compared to the hypocrisy of what the British and the French and the American governments were saying at the time. They're accusing Hitler and his movement of that, and yet they were the ones who wanted to conquer the world. And as things turned out, after the Axis powers were defeated, then it became a death struggle between the Soviet Empire and the American capitalist empire, and the Americans pretty much ended up winning that, and now there isn't any place in the world where the United States government will tolerate any sort of nationalist government or religious government. I mean, this is the problem we're having now with the Muslims. I mean, there's like a pattern to go in there, bring the people, penthouse magazines, pornography, drugs, immorality, break down their traditional immorality to turn them into passive consumers. They want people to be a consumer in the world economy and a sheep, a docile sheep that works their factories and their mines and enriches a certain international class. And it's pretty obvious. It's what has happened since the war.
Indeed. And the class, the merchant class, has always been the Jewish class. They've always been the traitors. They've always been the traitors, the merchants. And it's no different. They are now in charge of most multinational corporations. And that was set up. Those traditions were set up a long, long time ago.
Yes.
Yes, Commander Rockwell.
Go ahead.
Commander Rockwell pointed out that people are tied to the land. The people work the land and make their substance off of the land through their own work, their own creativity. But the Jews never had a land. They wandered among other peoples, and rather than working the land, they worked the people.
Who owned the land?
Who worked the land through deceptive tricks and lies and usury and all sorts of practices to gather the wealth of those people into their own hands. They've always been parasites on the back of humanity, going back by their own records 4,000 years. And this is something they talk about amongst themselves quite openly. They don't try to hide this at all.
Exactly. Sure. And they were certainly...
Yeah, Christ says, judge them by their fruits or their what they do. And you can see what's happening in Gaza as we speak. When they have the upper hand, all the things that they preach, tolerance, mercy, democracy, freedom, when they have the chance to show how much they believe in that with another people, they do the opposite. It's just a genocide taking place there, and it's being done in our name as Americans. Every American today, if we take a trip overseas, we're at risk of becoming the victim of a terrorist act because of what our government is doing, supporting these mad Zionists in the Middle East. And a lot of these Muslim and Arab people are desperate. I mean, they're just they're losing their land, they're losing their culture. And the only superpower in the world is backing up this belligerent little nation in order to do it. It's sort of like if you're a young guy and you go around sometimes bar hopping on a Friday night, once in a while you end up with a guy that's got a real big mouth, and because he knows all his buddies are going to back him up. And if you're smart, you stop hanging around with a guy like that because it always means a fight. Well, that's sort of the United States' relationship with Israel. They say, oh, they're our only, our strongest ally in the Middle East and our best friend. Well, that's because they're belligerent, arrogant. They pick fights with everybody. And, you know, we always end up, like, saving their neck.
Yeah, a few weeks ago in Haaretz, the newspaper out of Israel, they said there that the U.S. military aid to Israel has topped over $100 billion now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
$100 billion with a B.
Amazing. Think of what good that money would do for our country, rebuilding the infrastructure, just so many, many things. And why are we slaves to that tiny little piece of territory that was not theirs, that they never had any ethnic connection to that territory? And what is happening there now is just it's just terrible. And
the Zionists were offered one land after another, very fertile lands, very lands that were not occupied with people, and they turned down every place they were ever offered. They insisted they wanted Israel because it was the corner of the trading routes of three continents.
Mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely. It was, and it always had been. I mean, that was sort of the center of the old world, and of course we know that Islam at one point in time was very productive, very progressive. They had large educational institutions. They were performing surgery at an early time, you know, like in the 1400s. In fact, I understand Columbus actually got some of his education in where was it? Constantinople.
I think so.
Something like that.
Yeah, Constantinople was a very important city in years gone by.
Right. And I was thinking in terms of how the acquisition of spices was so important. And it just dawned on me recently that, because when you grow up, you think, oh, spices, oh, cinnamon. Yeah, I like cinnamon in my rice, or I like cinnamon in my cereal. No, spices were the essence of life. They were what has been given to us to protect our health, to use to make us better. They are the medicines that are natural, inherent, inherent medicines. And so that was a big deal.
They were used for preserving food, too, before you had refrigeration. Yeah, it was very important. Yeah, I used to wonder about that myself. What was the big thing about spices, you know?
Yeah, so they wanted cinnamon. Okay, well, what's so big about that?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's... the whole thing in the Middle East now, it's unfortunate that some nationalist movements are falling for... what the Jews, I think, are promoting and trying to turn their movements into this anti-Muslim thing. I understand the immigration is a problem, and in Europe it's a bigger problem in some ways. And, you know, I don't want to see Europe or any of the traditional Western homelands be anything but Western. But to fall for this, to get on this anti-Muslim thing in a way that just benefits the Jews is, I think, foolish, and it's just doing their dirty work for them. You know, they love it, and not all these groups are falling for that, but many of them are, and they need to really rethink that. I think we could have a dialogue with Muslims, that there wouldn't be a problem. They try to portray them as just crazed maniacs and uncompromising. Well, there may be some, but there's some like that with every group. But, you know, I always marveled at pictures of Hugo Chavez, Castro, Ahmadinejad, you know, and these different people meeting. Well, you have a Shiite Muslim, Catholic, and a communist, and they had friendly meetings together. And
sure.
I think the reason that could take place was because they were basically honest in their dealings with each other, and they respected each other's worldview and their own country, and they realized they had there was advantages to working together against colonialism,
the common enemy.
And Zionists. And I really think that each people in their respective lands could work things out. The Jews are the ones that stir things up, and they've always played one against the other for their advantage. It's a, have a long history of
sure.
that.
And you mentioned the problems in Europe with the immigration. When you consider all of the damage, all of the infrastructure that was destroyed during the first Gulf War, where they only had 4% of the electricity left, where they destroyed all of the electrical plants, they killed, murdered, you might as well say murdered, 500,000 children under the age of 5. You had a destroyed country, much the same as Germany was after World War II, and people immigrated, a lot of people immigrated from Germany after World War II. And so you have immigration as a result of warfare, and so people are going to move because, well, they feel it's a necessity, their life has been destroyed, their businesses maybe have been destroyed. Even if you look at a small community like Ferguson, when there's a lot of destruction, the businesses are not going to come back. And so you do have immigration from countries. And I don't, although I do believe some of the things that I have heard in the media about the rapes in Sweden or the rapes here or wherever, I think they are going to, that the media, and we have to remember who owns the media, that the media is going to exaggerate. And they are going to exaggerate the numbers and the problems. I have friends who are Muslim. There's a neighbor that's Muslim. Go ahead.
This is a problem that Commander Rockwell saw at the core of about 65 years back. Now, he stated the racial nature of this battle. And what what he was trying to tell people, what he was trying to get people to understand in this country, white America, was that all of these problems and issues that we discuss from day to day are simply problems. They are symptoms. They are not the cause. We have to look at the cause.
Yes.
And the cause ultimately gets back to one factor alone. That in white in America, at the time that Rockwell started his political activities, you're looking at a country that was about 95% white. The blacks did not have any power, and the whites did not have any power. In a land that was 95% white, the power was all in the hands of the Jew. And Rockwell said, this is not right. We need white power in America. Why don't we have white power? This is a white country. White people built this country. White people think of it as their own country, but when it comes to important matters, the Jews are always the ones calling the shots. And we cannot solve any of these problems that we discuss that come along from one day, one year to the next. We'll never solve any of these problems because we have no power to effect change or to make decisions. The Jews have that. We need to take the power away from the Jews and put it back in the hands of white America. We cannot do that with a white America that has no pride in their own race. We cannot do that with white Americans who do not even identify as being white. We cannot do that in a society, in a culture where the white race has been and is constantly vilified, that we have no heroes, we have only villains. The Jews, on the other hand, they never have villains. They only have heroes. They have saints. They are innocent and pure as the driven snow, and they are simply these evil white villains. That is the narrative we are all raised in. Even Rockwell did not question it when the propaganda was coming out that the United States had to go to war to save themselves from the Italians, the Germans, and the Japanese.
Right.
He hated Roosevelt. He couldn't stomach Eleanor Roosevelt, but yet he still had that simplistic naivete that the ordinary American of the day had, that his government would not lie to him. After the war, he found out his government, sure did lie to him, and he was going to find out why. And when he found out why, he was going to dig deep enough to find the source of it all, who was behind it, and he was going to stand up and fight, because he believed, above all things, that the truth must prevail. Commander Rockwell said, "Our sword is truth, our shield is faith and honor," and he proclaimed to white America. In late 1950s, he raised the banner of Adolf Hitler's National Socialist idea, and he proclaimed, "White man, fight. We must take this country back. We cannot allow this Jewish Bolshevik Zionist gang to dominate this land and to use and abuse our people any way they choose."
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a... Go ahead.
I was just going to say that this system we have in America with Jewish control of the nerve centers of the cultural and the news outlets, it's very good. People immigrate here, and in one or two generations, they lose their identity. I've often thought the Second World War, if the German Americans, Hungarian Americans, Irish Americans, Croats, Italians, I mean, you're talking about enormous numbers of American citizens. If they would have, or if even half of them would have said, "Hell no, we're not going to go fight that war. We have no interest in, you know, preserving the British Empire or promoting Zionism. And we should follow what, founding fathers preached, no foreign entanglements, and just stay here. And we have an enormous country here from coast to coast, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, the Canadian border, the Gulf of Mexico. We have rich farmland. We have mighty forests, minerals. If we can't live within those boundaries without invading someplace else, how do we expect anybody else to? How do we expect a country like, say, Libya, that has maybe just a couple miles along the coast where they can farm something? And we're so quick to condemn. I used to argue with some people during the Saddam Hussein thing. It's always meddling in affairs with his neighbors. I said, well, what would we say if they were here fooling around in Mexico? I mean, there's this mentality that, the American industrial Jewish combination can go anywhere in the world and stick their nose in and overthrow governments, do anything they want. But anybody else doesn't have the right to even right next door take an interest in it. And it's just incredible.
Interesting. Alrighty. You were talking about farmland, and earlier we were talking about how the Germans were really under the National Socialism. The German government made certain that the farmers were not burdened by heavy loans. They made educational systems available so that they would know how to work the land and how best to cultivate it. And yet in this country, in the last, three decades probably, we have seen this huge, huge growth of corporate farming, of getting rid of the independent farmer, of making it so difficult for them to live that they have to borrow so much money to plant, and then they end up giving back the money, paying back their loan when their crops are harvested, The government has made it so hard for the independent farmer that they are willing to sell out, and now corporate farming has taken over the entire country.
Yes. Yes, it's, you know, there's a big, with conservatives now and libertarian types, this big anti-government mentality. And it's, you know, it's partially, I think it's because we're so used to bad government that we've become anti-government in itself. But I like to say that government is a tool, and it's like a hammer. Big government, small government, a big hammer, small hammer. It depends on the job. You know, if you're putting upholstery on furniture, you need a little tack hammer. If you're driving in fence posts, you need a big sledgehammer. The tool of government or a hammer needs to be just as big or small as it needs to be to efficiently accomplish what you need done. And the job of government should be, I mean, business, the purpose of business is to make a profit for its owners. And that's why there's a natural conflict between, you know, business and labor traditionally, because labor's out to increase their wages, business is out to increase their profits, so there's a conflict. The role of government is to sort of oversee that struggle so it doesn't get out of hand. It's just one function. It's to look out for the common good. That's a big tenet in National Socialism, the common good.
Oh, absolutely. It's part of the German character.
Yes, and so you can't have a business that says, well, I can increase my profits by dumping my toxic waste into the river because the government steps in and says, you can't do that. You know, you can run your business, but you have to properly dispose of that toxic waste because, you know, we're here to protect all of our citizens, all the people.
Right.
And that's really what National Socialism is in conflict with this, you know, anti-government mentality that's so prevalent now. And I also say that most people today, the government sometimes oversteps its bounds, but most people are slaves not to the government but to some private corporation. I mean, the majority of people are told by a private corporation, you know, where they will be each day, what days they have off, you know, what doctor they can go to, how they can dress and cut their hair, you know. I mean, there are so many corporate things. I've worked for large corporations, and before you get hired, you sign a stack of papers, you know. And if you read them, you're basically signing away your constitutional rights in order to work for that company. And they say, well, you don't have to work here. You have the freedom not to work here. Well, you have the freedom to starve too, you know.
Sure.
Most people are forced to work for a corporation and do what they're told by the corporation. And the government, we can at least replace that. We have the ability to vote people out, and the government should be a tool of the people. But if they don't participate, I mean, I see it on a local level. Sometimes you're overwhelmed by national politics. You figure, what use is it? But even on a local level, these county commission meetings or little town councils, they say the first law of politics is to show up. You know, if people just show up, it's amazing on a local level what a half a dozen people can do, the impact it can have. But people come home from work, they're tired, the weekend comes, they have things to do, and it's usually, you know, the business class or people who, you know, a lot of times these meetings are held on a weekday in the afternoon, and most people can't attend. But our founding fathers set it up. We have like civic duties. They used to teach civics in school, how to be a good citizen. Now we just work for a corporation, most of us, and then we come home and we want to try to entertain ourselves with something until it's time to go back to work again. We neglect our religious duties to God, which however we choose to worship. We neglect our civic duties to our country. We even neglect family duties. People used to visit on Sundays. They'd go to church and then they'd visit relatives or friends. Now everybody just goes to Walmart and shops. It's crazy.
Wow, you're right. You're right. Yeah, people used to get together People used to know their neighbors, and now it's they're so involved with work and getting their kids to soccer practice and all of the other things. Children have no time to be children anymore. And
I think that's a problem with capitalism. It's not that the economics is necessarily, I mean, it has to be controlled, I think, by a government that looks out for the common good. But the worst thing about it is it becomes a culture. It becomes a culture of consumerism and materialism at the expense of everything else, the deeper, more important things in our lives, you know, a knowledge and a feeling for who we are, where we came from, and the idea that our lives, you know, we were blessed with a life and we have the chance to contribute something to this stream of our ancestors in the past and future generations, to make our lives count for that, not just to accumulate as much, you know, junk as we can, because, you know, we're going to go out of this world the same way we came in. So
sure. And of course, as you said before, it's driven by corporatocracy.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, 30,
you know, Rod,
are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm listening to my guy. He's doing such a fine job. I don't want to interrupt him.
You're both doing a great job.
Yeah, well, this go ahead, my girl.
Oh, I just say, like, 30-06 and I, we got involved with this, I think, probably around the same time. And it was after Rockwell had been killed, but there were still a lot of Rockwell guys around. And I always felt real good. I was a young man. The first demonstration I went on with it was already the National Socialist White People's Party at that time, led by Matt Cale. And
I love him. I've had him on my program. He's such a fine.
Have you? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, he. There were still, you know, these old Rockwell guys would show up, and I was 17 years old when I first went on a demonstration and was arrested, actually, for parading without a permit.
That distinction.
But it was kind of it was the first time I remember my knees were knocking. I mean, I was just a little old country boy who was only 40 miles outside of Philadelphia, but I was raised all around dairy farms and knew your neighbors. And next thing you know, I'm jumping out of a car with a bunch of other guys with brown shirts and swastika armbands, and the police are swarming us, and there's a irate communist black mob there waiting to kill us, and I'll admit, my knees were knocking, you know? I said, you know, right there in Washington, D.C., everything was different and alien and scary to me, you know? And those old Rockwell guys being there, they were, you know, it's like in a war where you have the seasoned troops go with the green guys, you know. So you'd watch them and you'd see their how they acted, and you gradually found your nerve and you figured it out yourself. But I mean, Rockwell, these guys are still, I know a couple of them, see them every once in a while, and most of them are, I guess, in their 70s now. And they were the young guys with Rockwell, because I guess he'd be in his 90s. But they're still active, many of them. He attracted some really hardcore people, people who took it seriously. And 30-06 is one of them. But we were kind of the second generation, you know, because Rockwell was already.
Yeah, we came in there just in time to, we were, Magyar and myself, we were there with all the men who were there with Rockwell. So we were there just in time to get that training directly from them, who got it directly from Rockwell. And that's why we are so familiar with Commander Rockwell, because we never stopped asking questions of all the guys. We wanted to know everything. And so we heard it from the people who were there. We did not have the misfortune of reading about it in a book or reading about it on the internet later, where there's so much confusion and so much falsehoods that spread around.
Sure.
But I was going to say that, and this is relates back to what Rockwell's message was back in the 1950s. He said, we were talking about these problems, corporations, the government, and so forth. And this was what Rockwell was trying to tell people, that we cannot cure these problems until we have control of our destiny again. And what he tried to tell people then was that we have the power. White America has the power. All we have to have is the will to exercise that power. And I think that still stands true today, that white America has the power. It is white America that will make the decision. White America, through their action or through their inaction, will determine. It's just, we were talking about the over $100 billion of U.S. aid to Israel. That is because white America is sitting back in complacency and allowing the Jews to run the show in this country. Now, let's just look at this for a moment and see just which crowd is doing this. Is this the comic book and cheap magazine and baseball fans? Are these the people doing it? No, not really. It's that element that should be the radical element. It's that element that should be the fanatics. But unfortunately, they have allowed finks and infiltrators provided by the enemy to talk them out of their fanaticism. And this is what Rockwell tried to get across to them, that you cannot mount an aggressive battle and an all-out war without absolute fanaticism and passion. And we still hear this today, especially on the Internet. We've got to tone things down. We can't afford the newspaper readers, the TV watchers. We can't offend them. We must win them over. Well, you win them over after you've taken power, the same way Adolf Hitler did in Germany. Mm-hmm. Adolf Hitler came into power in Germany. He did not have the support of the majority of the Germans in 1933. What he had was, he had the largest organization. He had the largest amount of support of any of the political parties.
Right.
He won the German people over in the next year and the year after that through the accomplishments that he provided for the Germany.
Mm-hmm.
That's when he won the people over. You win the masses after you have power and you can do something with it.
But he still had power legally. He did it legally.
Yes, he was elected in July of 1932, and the courts, being as corrupt as they were, they said, well, that election doesn't count. The wrong guy won, so we'll do it again.
Right.
They had five elections. He won all five elections.
Exactly.
That's when finally Hindenburg and his name escapes me right now, but they said, we've got to appoint Hitler as chancellor or the government's just going to collapse out of its sheer mockery it's made out of itself.
Sure.
Defying the will of the people five times in a row like that. We can't have that. And that's how that occurred. But he was elected in July, or was it June? No, I think it was July 1932 in the first election. Might have been June. But five times they had elections, but five times they override them. Just like here. The United States says they won elections in the Middle East, so Hamas gets elected and says, oops, wrong guy won. That doesn't count.
Exactly. Well, but he did. One of the beauties about him is that he got rid of the union, and he allowed the business owner and the workers to both have common ground, so that they weren't competitive. He allowed them to work out their differences. He didn't create a division. Like in this country, when the unions came in, they came in order to destroy business. And he could see that happening in Germany also, because the unions were typically set up by the communists.
Yep.
And
yep.
So he talked to the common man, he talked to the business owners, and made them see that they needed to be on the same side.
Well, as Magyar Saxon pointed out, the role of government, the proper role of government, and Hitler demonstrated this in relation to labor in the unions and the management in Germany.
Right.
He simply declared and demanded that the businesses provide decent working conditions for the workers. He instituted the 40-hour work week there. He established certain minimum pay rates. He demanded they provide cafeterias with good, healthy meals and clean restroom facilities and sports facilities and relaxation centers. In a factory, you often see, if you go to YouTube, you can look up and see a lot of times you'll see concerts in factories. This was done. They would come in maybe once a week and have all the employees in the factory go sit down for an hour and a half, and listen to a concert. This is for relaxation, for the health, the psychological, the mental, and the renewal of the people, their health. Work should not be, Hitler said this again and again, work should not be a drudgery. It shouldn't be something that wears a man down. He instituted the Strength Through Joy program, where the average German person could travel and experience things that they never could before that, or that they never could in other countries. When he had these ships built, Wilhelm Gustloff and others, these huge ocean-going liners to take Germans on voyages on these vacations that he instituted. Every business must give the worker so many weeks vacation every year. Those ships were banned from England. English would not let them come in there because they could not dare let the impoverished English working class see how well the German working class had it under National Socialism, because then all the Jewish propaganda about the evils of fascism would fall flat.
Right.
But I think what Hitler did was manage the natural conflicts that exist in this world, managed it. And the key is that always keeping that common good in mind. I mean, there are natural conflicts between business and labor, between men and women, between young people and old people, between country and city folk and all, but if you go about resolving those things with a common good in mind, it works. I think we live in a universe of it's natural that there's stress and tension. I mean, the planets and the stars and they pull against each other. But if everything's balanced properly, that natural tension it keeps everything in order and going properly. But what's bad is when you have aliens that have their own agenda come in and take over any aspect of these natural struggles and try to use them for their own benefit, and they disorder the society, the people. For instance, like feminism. I mean, in National Socialist Germany, there were women who were, did extraordinary things. Leni Riefenstahl, the filmmaker, Hannah Reiss, the test pilot, there's all kind of examples, but they recognize that there's a natural role that most men and most women tend to have their own natural areas of activity, and it's wrong to try to deliberately disrupt that, what comes natural, and where I think most people would be happy. But you have to allow for the individuals who want to contribute something outside that normal range of activity. So it's just a matter of keeping that common good in mind.
Sure. And then you have the how feminism was part of the culture. Well, we were talking about cultural differences and the trauma and the change in the 60s. And you have to bring up the feminist movement, which was started by Gloria Steinem and Betty and Friedan. And I mean, these people were, Steinem worked for the CIA. And the CIA is, of course, run by the corporations for the benefit of the corporations. And so you can see what she did, what she was paid to do, and what she had helped doing was to create division between men and women, because up to that point, I think women were pretty satisfied with what they were doing. But then after listening to her talk, and she was very persuasive, you'd think, well, yeah, she's got a point there. Yeah, I don't want to just stay home and have kids. I want it all. Well, you know, there's no having it all. You have to make choices in life. You do make choices in life. And so the children tended to fall through the cracks and become, here's the key. When you get home from school, just let yourself in and turn on the American Bandstand or whatever.
Yeah, even to an extent it happened with the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, the situation in the United States was such that you know, segregation was not something that that could last. I know my mother's side of the family, they had my grandmother had a cousin in Tennessee, and my mother, as a young girl, visited, and she was raised in Pennsylvania, so she never saw like segregation like that, and she was really upset by, you know, separate water fountains and blacks riding on the bus, and just she was uncomfortable with you know, making other people feel inferior. It just was not
sure.
Something somebody raised in the North was used to. So that was a system that I think was doomed, you know, and Rockwell said it too. He said he didn't think segregation would work. It was over. It ran its course. And but he felt that integration was a terrible thing, you know, and he felt that the only solution was basically separation. And, you know, when you look at the world today, or this country today, I mean, black people really, in some ways, I mean, there's some very successful blacks, but, I mean, the violence and the drugs and the conditions that many blacks live in today, it's not much better than, it's probably worse than when they had their own separate schools and their own separate communities more.
Sure.
And, yeah, so it's... I think we need to have, and that's the funny thing about Rockwell, because, you know, sometimes he would talk, he would say things, and he often said that he agitates in the streets because it's the only way to get publicity, and people have to remember now, this is before the Internet, and so he would, you know, shout things like talk about Martin Luther Coon and the cannibal congressman from New York, Stokely Carmichael, or Adam Clayton Powell, and he would use very provocative.
I remember we used to call him Stoke 'em Up Carbuncle.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, then he would do that like on the street sometimes. But then when he would get before a college audience, or he would write something, he very often spoke highly of the black Muslims and what they were trying to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Black
mm-hmm.
nationalists. And I think that we're at a different age here, and it's easy for some people to point to some of the more inflammatory things that Rockwell did and say, oh, how can you want to be a part of that or something like that? But you have to remember the times. And you can also point he said that he thought the business of hating Negroes was insane, and he spoke fondly on many occasions he spoke sympathetically of the plight of black people. And I don't think, you know, if you take the Jew agitators out of the picture, I don't think white nationalists and black nationalists would have any problem, or not much of a problem, working something out to the mutual benefit of both peoples. I really
sure.
don't. And there may be, you know, there may be people that want to mix, and maybe they should be allowed to place that they want to. But the people who want to preserve their own cultural and heritage, whether black, white, or anything else, ought to be allowed to do that without constantly being under attack from international, you know, sources that want to destroy all peoples for their own agenda.
This is what Commander Rockwell recognized in the 1950s, was that this so-called civil rights movement was aimed at the destruction of the social structure and the family structure of white America and black America. He realized that this would only have devastating results for both white and black America, and that it certainly has. The white, I can remember... when black America was an entirely different picture than it is today. I can remember when the blacks had the family structure. They don't have that anymore. Most of them, most young black people are in single family homes. The mother's there, multiple kids, no father. They do not have stable family life. And I can remember back in the 1950s when that was not the case. I remember in the 1950s they had their family life. And every Sunday they would all get dressed up in suits and go to church, and they had a certain respectability amongst them. This was eliminated with the civil rights movement and the communist agitation. The whole thing was a ploy by the Jews to take over the leadership of black America as well as the leadership of white America. to take it over at every level. They had control of the United States since at least 1913 when they instituted so many things that destroyed this country. And then in that year, the Federal Reserve Act, the establishment of the NAACP by the two Jewish Smingarn brothers from Boston, the passage of the 16th Amendment, the income tax, the election of senators by popular vote rather than by state legislatures. So many things were done to overthrow the American Republic and replace it with a Jewish-controlled democracy. And so they controlled the things from at the highest level, but they did not control every neighborhood. This was the purpose of the Civil Rights Movement, to allow them to take over and control every neighborhood. As Rockwell pointed out in his speeches in 1964 when he tried to rally the people to attend the August 28th demo in Washington, he pointed out that this was an attack designed to destroy private property rights in the United States. That was the real goal, and they were using the lesser-thinking blacks who were whipped up by Jewish Bolshevik propaganda in their emotional pitch to them to bring this pressure to bear on Washington to get this passed. Martin Luther King led that march down there. He had 250,000 black marchers, and Commander Rockwell put out a call. He spoke all over towns, all over Virginia. Thousands of people would come out and listen to Commander Rockwell, and they all pledged they would join him in Washington in counter-demonstrating against that civil rights march in August 28, 1963. When it come down to the day of August 28th, Rockwell and 87 of his members marched against that black horde. Not one other person joined them after thousands, tens of thousands said pledged they would be there. And this was what Rockwell was fighting against. It's what he realized he was up against, was that white of America had lost its will. And that's what he saw as his mission, to inspire white America to buckle up and get their will back. As he said, he believed that white Americans controlled this country. They were the power. They were simply not exercising it. They needed the willpower to exercise their rightful power and to stop allowing these parasites to use this country for their own international end.
Mm-hmm. I remember that march. We had relatives in Maryland, and we were I-95 wasn't even finished through then. I remember my mother driving my grandmother and us kids down Old Route 1, and there'd be busloads of Greyhound buses, all kind of buses filled with blacks, and coming from Boston and New York and everywhere, heading to D.C. And I remember saying, "That's the Negroes are marching for their rights," you know. And I was raised. There was no hatred, and you know, people sometimes, these Jews, like, if somebody becomes a National Socialist, they like to say, "Well, what is their psychological problem?" I mean, in one sense, we all have psychological. I think Jung said that everybody would benefit from from psychoanalysis. But I mean, I think about as normal as the next guy, as my family. I was raised in a loving family. Never taught any kind of hatred or anything, and was in the Boy Scouts. My father was a World War II veteran. It was just typical American. But at some point, something catches in you where it becomes important to you. And I used to marvel at that in the old NSWPP days, when we go to one of the congresses that they'd have on Labor Day, and I'd look around, and these guys would be from Ohio and Chicago and Los Angeles and Philadelphia and all over down in the South, and think, what, there'd be a hand, maybe 60, 70 guys there and gals, and think, well, what is it that brings these people together? This swastika and Rockwell is like a magnet that drew these individuals out from all over the country, and it was important enough to them that they spent their time and their money and their effort to come and be here at this thing, to go get yelled at and have things thrown at them and the cops arrest them and everything like that. It was really an unusual group, you know, and it's a shame that today some of the groups who actually wear a brown shirt and armband. It really sort of degenerated, and they've just like kind of picked up on, like I said, the inflammatory things that maybe Rockwell and Zog flying over my house.
Oh.
Over here with jets, military jets once in a while.
They picked up on the
more inflammatory trappings of some of the things that were done, and they just get out there with their beer bellies and tattoos and shout Sieg Heil, and they really are a discredit to National Socialism, to Rockwell, and to the whole movement.
Exactly.
Not saying all of them, but that's not what it's about. It's not about hatred. It's or starting fights for the sake of starting fights.
Sure.
The SA formed to protect, because the National Socialists were the ones that were first attacked. They wouldn't allow them to speak, so that's why they had to form like paramilitary groupings to protect their own speakers.
Right. I just noted that we do have a caller that has a question, maybe. So let's see what the caller. This is from actually from your own area, 304-551. Okay, let's see. Caller, did you have a question?
Yeah, hi, Dan. This is Ken from West Virginia.
I
grew up in Northern Virginia, and I remember when I was young, Rockwell was in Alexandria, Arlington or something. He could have been in the news, when I was young. And I don't remember. He was killed by somebody, I believe, one of his lieutenants or something. Could they enlighten us on about that story and whether there's any scandal involved in it or conspiracy or anything? I think he was killed. I'm not sure.
He was assassinated. Yeah.
Who did it?
Are you all six? You want to take that?
Oh, why don't you take that, Magyar?
Well, I there's a fellow by the name of John Patler, whose real name was Patlos. He was, I think...
That's Salos.
Yeah, okay. He was of Greek ethnicity. And I don't know all the details. I've heard stories from guys down through the years. But apparently he had been thrown out of the party by Rockwell fairly recently before he was assassinated. And I believe that a couple weeks before Rockwell was killed, somebody had fired a shot at him from a wooded area.
Yeah, that was in June.
Okay. And the bullet hit right above Rockwell's head, and Rockwell, being the kind of guy he was, just leaped out of the car and started chasing the guy, and the guy was chasing him through. It was a wooded area. They used to call it, the press referred to it as Hate Monger Hill, there's a park there now. It's right across from where Rockwell was killed, and there was a big old house there that a wealthy widow, I believe, let them use for a party headquarters. But in that woods there, it was a big estate. Somebody had taken a shot at him, and a lot of people felt that was Patler. And then, August 25th, he was killed. And if you search the internet, you can find some details about it. There's pictures of Rockwell laying there in a parking lot, and there's accounts of how the police, the local police there, kind of knew who the Nazi guys were, so they saw Patler standing on a corner, I believe, with I think he had walked through a creek or something, and he looked a little suspicious, and they picked him up. Anyway, they ended up finding the gun. It matched the bullets and so forth. And I knew Dr. Pierce pretty well, and I used to talk to him about Rockwell sometimes, and I remember him telling me that when Rockwell was shot at the couple weeks before he was killed, Pierce told me that they all felt it was Patler. And he actually said that when Patler was thrown out by Rockwell, a number of them said to each other, "We better watch it now," because he kind of had a reputation, I think, as a hothead. And but then there's, you know, there's a there's suspicion about how he got off so easy. I mean, he was sentenced, I think, to 10 years.
20 years. The state law in Virginia was the minimum sentence he could receive was 20 years. Ken, I think we're getting some interference from your phone. We didn't have that before. Reposition your phone or something?
Okay.
Okay, it's a little
better.
Quieter
now.
A little bit now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, where was I? Oh, okay, the Virginia state law, 20 years was the minimum that he could have received. He received a 20-year sentence, but he only spent about, I forget now whether it was either 6 or 8 years in prison, and most of that, he had been released from prison after only 3 or 4 years or 2 years or something like that, and then he got in trouble for a parole violation and was sent back for another 4 years. So he actually got more time for a parole violation than he did for murdering Commander Rockwell.
Hmm.
Yeah, so there was, and I heard that he had, you know, money for the defense. Now, that could have just been the fact that, you know, Jews or anybody who didn't like Rockwell maybe just felt like contributing to his defense or something. But, yeah, I don't know. There has been rumors about him getting paid to do it and put up to it and all. And I think some of the Rockwell guys were trying to investigate that after the fact. But
it's
I don't know that there's ever been any definitive proof of that.
Well, it's kind of too involved to go into, and we just don't have the time to cover it, actually.
To go into what, Frank Joseph?
The assassination.
Right.
It's a long story.
There is quite a bit on the internet now. If you just search.
Yeah, but there's all the insinuated rumors from the ADL camp. They're all over the internet too.
Yeah.
Any other questions, Ken?
I just remember that at the time, you know, I grew up, you know, like I said, I grew up, and there was quite a bit. And then when he was killed, it's sort of the. There was never any. He was like the star of the movement, and once he was gone, then it was sort of faded away. So I'm just curious. I didn't, you know, I was too young to really remember the story about that. So thanks for that. It just fills it all in for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ken.
All right. Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Yeah. What Ken said, he definitely was irreplaceable. You know, he was just an odd combination of, you know, he had an unusual background coming from a family that was involved with vaudeville, and then he had, you know, he would sail boats. He always had, I guess what they call an orange personality. He was sort of a daredevil and a, like, physical fear. He didn't have a lot of physical fear of things. He had a lot of courage, you know, and then, so he became a pilot in the Navy and all that, and so you combine that with this high intelligence and this vaudeville background from his parents, and then like a fighter pilot, and he was impressive. He cut an impressive figure physically. Yeah, you know, he's a big, tall, good-looking guy, and he just very confident in his demeanor. And you add it all up, and I mean, I sometimes now. You know, when I first started admiring Rockwell and getting involved with his group after he was killed, I didn't realize as a kid or such a young man that how rare he really was. But it's only now at this age and all these decades later that I see that there's nobody has ever really replaced him, you know. And I remember one time Dr. Pierce said to me that he really believes that if there would have been 50 or 100 Rockwells, at that time, that there could have been like a nationalist revolution in the country. He felt that he was that dynamic. And I remember Dr. Pierce also told me one time, he said, we used to argue like hell with each other. He said, but there's many times when there's nobody I would rather talk with discuss something with in Rockwell. So, Dr. Pierce had a lot of respect for him.
Here's a little something written by Dr. Pierce about Rockwell. He said, "To Rockwell, evil must be opposed. Good must be upheld. To pretend that the world is other than it is was self-defeating. To lie about it or to try to fool others about it was unthinkable. Once his eyes were open to the Jews and what their policies were doing to America, there is no question of keeping his mouth shut and going on about his business. He had to speak out against them. He had to fight them. He would fight them anywhere, anytime, under any conditions, no matter what the odds. And he would fight them with all the strength of his being. I'm sure that if there were had just been 1,000 men like Rockwell in America in 1966, we'd be living in a healthy, progressive, all-white America today." That's what Dr. Pierce had to say about Commander Rockwell.
Right. Now, who did take over? Who did assume control?
Matthias McHale took over. He was the Party National Secretary from about 1963. He joined Commander Rockwell in 1960 and opened a headquarters in Chicago. He ran the Chicago unit for 3 years. Then Commander Rockwell transferred him to Arlington. He became the National Secretary. He was a major in the party, and he was staunchly loyal to Commander Rockwell. He was instrumental in putting down several coup attempts by ADL types, people had been not sincere. And, he was the second in charge, and he took over. And the news media, here's a good example of how the Jews do not hesitate to lie to white Americans. They think they can deceive white America with impunity. The National Socialist White People's Party continued, and it became the most active pro-white and anti-communist organization in America in the 1970s. We had about 40 units in the early 70s. We were having demonstrations every week in every one of those units. And these were very dramatic demonstrations many times. And but now if you go to the Discovery Channel or History Channel on television in the 1990s, they were producing all these documentaries telling us that, well, when Rockwell was shot, that was the end of the party, until this cockroach in Illinois started a group called the National Socialist Party of America and proceeded to march on Skokie and terrorize all these poor, innocent Holocaust survivors who were pure and innocent as the driven snow and just victims of these evil villains, the Germans.
Right.
And, of course, he was nothing but a front man and a pitch man to build up. The media had him in the news every week, every day for about 2 years. And all it really was just a front man advertising a $100 million project that Spielberg had put together. He produced his long, boring story called Holocaust. And he wanted to make sure when the theaters opened, people would have heard enough about this.
Exactly.
That they would have been curious enough to run off to the theaters, and he could recoup his $100 million and make another $100 million in the process. And again, of course, inform all the younger generation of young white Americans and others how these Germans were such evil villains. And the Jews were pure and innocent as the driven snow, and just victims as they have been for the last 4,000 years at the hands of these other villainous peoples.
Right. And, of course, you're talking about Frank Joseph.
Yeah, old Frankie Cohen.
Yes. He's Frank Joseph nowadays, but he used to be somebody else.
But yep. It's true that after Rockwell was killed, it did eventually sort of... come apart into some factions, and it was the times were getting more and more radical, and so you had some of these different groups, different leaders of the various units had different ideas, and they had their own kind of loyalty, because you didn't have Matt Cale. I think he was a sincere guy, but he didn't have the charisma that Rockwell did. So it's when a great leader goes, there's infighting, and that's what happened, and eventually sort of led to things like dissipating over time. It really did.
Well, plus you had the radicalization of the Anti-Defamation League and the B'nai B'rith and the FBI COINTEL program to destroy that party. They spent millions of dollars, 55% of those millions being taxpayer money through the FBI. They spent millions of dollars, they say, in their own admission before the US, United States Senate Security Subcommittee hearings to fund the establishment of and to create hundreds of phony groups to try and draw off support from the NSWPP and to create confusion amongst the white American population.
Right.
That's what the government does for you.
Right. And yeah. They were starting to actually do that during the 30s when there was a lot of support for Germany that they would send in the police and break up any kind of meetings and bash people's heads in. And they actually used the services of, well, some of the tough guys in the country.
They hired the mafia and the union-controlled longshoremen. When I first got involved in storm troops activities, same time Magyar did, the communists used to hire longshoremen and come out and protect their demonstrations. And we would go out there and attack them and rip down their Viet Cong flags anyways.
There was a lot of... remember how close you could get to the White House and all, too? They have it all blocked off now. I was down there recently. I participated in a demonstration for Gaza, a pro-Palestinian march, and it's very different. I mean, there's snipers up on the roof now, and they...
It's a disgrace.
Things were a lot looser back then, you know?
We used to have demos right there, right in front of the White House gate. I led demos in front of the White House there, and they had the gate there, and the limousine would come up, and then the first limousine would be Henry Kissinger and Golda Meir, and the second limousine there would be Dick Nixon and Moshe Dayan. And I'm standing right there, 3 feet away from the window of the limousine, with a sign that says, Dump Israel. And... Henry Kissinger went frothing at the mouse, and he's spitting all over the window of the inside of the car. He went rabid.
Yeah, and, you can't Golda Meir, she leaned over. Football field of those guys now, yeah.
Yeah, and Golda Meir, she leaned over, she looked at me, and she gave me the finger.
Really?
Yeah, so then that gate opened, that limousine goes in. They closed the gate. Next limousine comes in, and Dick Nixon sitting on this side of the limousine, and Moshe Dayan sitting over there. And Nixon looks at me, and he just puts his hands in his head and shakes his hands, and you're like, oh, no, not him again. And Moshe Dayan, he just looked at me, and he didn't get hysterical like Kissinger did, but he was more the military type anyways.
How funny.
Yeah, I remember that.
Those must be wonderful memories to have.
Yeah, I had some go-arounds there with the – I remember this one cop trying to arrest me one day in front of the White House, and I wouldn't let him. That's a story in itself.
Really?
Yeah, I actually got away. He tried to, I just continued my demo, and I just wasn't paying no attention to him. I spoiled his day. He got so fuming mad over that.
Good.
I'd like to mention one fellow who was one of the best National Socialists I ever knew in my life. His name was Richard Biederman, who he ended up going in joining the Rhodesian Army, and he was killed in Mozambique, I believe. And there's a lot of stories about how he was, I think he was trying to recruit National Socialists from the Rhodesian Army and turn, because they knew that Ian Smith back then was getting ready to sell out the country. And knowing Biederman, he was probably trying to convert the Rhodesian forces into a National Socialist force. And there's rumor that he was actually killed by a M15 British agent, and because I know some other guys who were over there at the time, and
they had to take.
But he was a guy who just was he was a great National Socialist and absolutely fearless, you know. And,
They had to take Biedermann out before they could sell out the Rhodesians. The way they went about that sellout, they wouldn't have got away with it, Biedermann there. And he was too influential. He had a great record there. He was the type of person that was noticed. He was just like he was in this country, the natural-born leader. And yeah. he was the greatest.
Well, who are some of the other people? Now, you've mentioned Dr. William Pierce. And, of course, he's well-known, I believe, by certain people. So tell us a little bit about him. We just have about 4 minutes left.
William Pierce left as a physics professor out in a university in Oregon. He left a position there to go to Arlington, Virginia in 1965 and join Commander Rockwell.
Wow.
And, Commander Rockwell attracted and inspired dedicated idealists, men and women who dedicated themselves to their race with pride and passion for their race, and they never quit. They just kept on fighting. Yes, there were those who were there for more political reasons, and they drifted away sometime, but this was the impact that Rockwell had. He raised up this cadre of people, carried on the fight in whatever format and whatever way they could. And we would simply not have this.
David Duke.
Yes,
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I believe David Duke was attracted to Rockwell originally. Yes.
Yes, he was. And this, we would simply not have the awareness of this Jewish conspiracy against humanity today. We would not have nearly the awareness of this if it had not been for Commander Rockwell and his will and determination to stand and to fight this.
Right.
He was an exemplary individual, and he had a huge impact, and he accomplished his mission. He told Ralph Forbes in 1963, he said, "There's nothing the Jews can do about it. It's too late. We've let the Pandora out of the box, and the Jews cannot put it back in. We have exposed them to white men and women and other peoples all around the world, and their dirty deeds are not now exposed for all to see. We've exposed them. They can't cover it up again."
Well, you know, Hitler one time said that what a leader is, he said a leader is an example. That's the number one thing that a leader is to be an example. And that Rockwell certainly was. And that's something I think all of us that are still active and want to become active need to remember. We need to be examples of what we represent, good examples. And if we do that, I think we'll do well, because times are changing. The information's available now about the truth of these things. I've always remained optimistic all my life with this, and sometimes I wonder on what grounds, but there's something in me that I just remain optimistic that ultimately we'll have success with organizing the best European, best members of the European race around National Socialism, because I don't think there will be a white race left 500 years from now without them holding up Adolf Hitler and George Lincoln Rockwell and people
Indeed.
Like that.
Indeed. Well, gentlemen, thank you so very, very much for being on the program today and for your information. We've learned a lot today, and I thank both of you for joining me. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Deanna. I just want to mention notimeforsilence.wordpress.com. I have a page on Commander Rockwell there, and you can hear his words for yourself.
Exactly.
NoTimeForSilence.wordpress.com.
Thank you. Thank you for reminding us.
I appreciate the opportunity to honor this great man, George Lincoln Rockwell.
I want to thank you for being with us today, Medgar.
Yes. Thank you both, gentlemen. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.